good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Clean Energy View, which is a special series about the world of clean energy and produced by the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcasts are available on iTunes, Zune, or you can find us on your favorite podcast provider. You can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com, where you can subscribe to our newsletter to find out about upcoming guests, events, and other shows on our network. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is brought to you by LiquidWeb.com, the most reliable hosting provider with 24/7 heroic support. Listeners of the Clean Energy View, which is part of the Organic View Radio Network, can receive either $100 in credit towards Storm servers, which includes VPS and dedicated servers, or can try LiquidWeb's shared hosting for free for 1 month simply by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW. Today my guest is Michael Lewis, and we're going to be discussing his book, The Resilience Imperative: Cooperative Transitions to a Steady State Economy. Now, although the world recognizes the fact that we must develop renewable energy technologies, the cost of the technology is still unaffordable for many people and businesses. Is it possible to get our economy back on track while simultaneously making it more socially, environmentally, and financially sustainable? Well, that's basically what we're going to be talking about today. For those of you that are not familiar with Mr. Lewis, Michael Lewis is the executive director of the Center for Community Enterprise and is well known internationally as a practitioner, author, educator, and the leader in the field of community economic development. So I would like to welcome to the show Mr. Michael Lewis. Good morning, Mr.
Lewis. Thank you, June. Good morning, June. Thank you for having me on. It's just terrific. Looking forward to it.
Now, Mr. Lewis, can you explain to our audience just a little bit more about your background so that people can also visit your website, and especially for those that wish to get more involved can do so?
Yeah, okay. Well, basically for many, many years, been operating a nonprofit enterprise. It's actually called now the Canadian Center for Community Renewal. But historically, the concern was, well, how do we empower communities that, for one reason or another, have been marginalized from the mainstream economy? And how do we help people who are, you know, experiencing poverty or dislocation to, in fact, get back on their feet? And what we've done is essentially help in many, many different contexts in Canada and elsewhere to create the kinds of community-based organization, multi-stakeholder, if you will, business, labor, community organizations, to start moving towards having social goals and improvement in the community through using various economic and business means. So that's been our historic role. More recently, we've been looking at how can we deal with this in the age of climate change and peak oil, and what does that mean for our future, and what does it mean in terms of how we proceed?
Now, having said that, it's been my experience that until people have a personal reason to really start taking a closer look at these different issues, it really needs to become more personal. So how do you make that connection so that more, not just homeowners, but businesses will make that effort to start looking into different renewable energy technologies?
Well, I think, you know, there's no single answer. I think it's important. The premise of your question is all of us have to come to terms, or not, at some point with what's happening in our world. And you know, I think that is important. And on the very personal level, you know, for me, it was this kind of growing background awareness that all of a sudden broke through around climate change and our overdependence on fossil fuels when I started have grandchildren. And as that process started and as my study of these issues started, the need for significant and radical reexamination of what we were doing as an organization and what I was doing personally took place. So I think for all of us, we're on a journey, and that's part and parcel of what I think many people are trying to come to terms with in terms of the challenges we face as people on the planet. When it comes to the question of how do we take something, for instance, around energy conservation, which, you know, is the low-hanging fruit when it comes to carbon reduction, if you will, is that we can use much less energy and much more efficiently. And how do we do that? And how are people motivated to come to terms with that? It's interesting to know that this is absolutely an important question when it comes to dealing with carbon reduction. I'm not sure what the figures are in the United States, but in the European Union, their research over many, many years has come to the conclusion that 50% of carbon emissions can actually be traced back to household decisions. Among those are, of course, our dependence on oil and other kinds of non-renewable sources of energy for our electricity needs and for our heating needs. And what the European Union decided is that they really needed to have a community-based approach to actually penetrating the household level, to create a system that would both educate, animate, communicate, and actually create the knowledge and the motivation and the means by which people could, in fact, be supported to take action in reducing their energy use, increase their energy savings from an income point of view, and reduce carbon, both at the household level and at the community level. So that is pretty key, and that's certainly, you know, one of the things that we examined in the book, or in the energy chapter. One of the particular examples we used, which was quite dramatic, was from Kirklees, England, and they made huge progress.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of the things that they did that were significantly different as opposed to other community-type initiatives that other cities or regions have tried that really made the difference between the success helped the program to be successful?
Okay, well, let me begin by saying how in our federal government in Canada and many of our provincial governments, they approach it, and that will really help people understand the contrast. So much of the work that has taken place as a result of public policy at different levels in Canada has essentially been, we'll give you some rebates on the energy conservation investments you make and help with the audit to start with, and then you do the work, you get the contractor, you finance the entire operation, and after we see that you've done everything you said you've done, we'll give you a rebate on the effort. So really it's the individual, usually through a web-based kind of application, that get on to the program, and, you know, 2 years later they can collect the money. So that's the way we've been doing it in Canada, to the extent that we've been doing it at all, okay? Now, what they did in Kirklees, which was very interesting, now Kirklees first is, you know, 300,000 people, and they share a problem that I think is probably worse in the UK than it is in Canada or the US. 27% of their carbon emissions come from residential sector. So it's a huge leaky place over there in terms of housing. A lot of energy wasted, a lot of wasted householder income, and just emitting tons and tons and tons of carbon. So, I mean, the government's were aware of this, and they had tons of different programs, right? There's an energy audit program here, a rebate program over there. Here's a web-based list of qualified vendors in your area. Here's an application for subsidized insulation for households that are poor. A lot of different programs and different silos across different government departments. You had to be a friggin' brilliant manager, to be able to access that. So the local government knew this was a problem, and in the municipal council of Kirklees, which is about 300,000 people, just said this isn't working. They were aware of the European research that I mentioned earlier, and as it turns out, the European Union had a pilot program, and they said, look, we'll put up 50% of the cash of the pilot. Municipality's got to put up the rest of the cash, and the condition is it's got to be arm's-length, community-based, nonprofit enterprise or some kind of community-based capacity that can integrate a menu of things in order to qualify. So they created a group called Kirklees Energy Services, and they essentially developed the capacity to do kind of a full one-stop shopping service that was very proactive and out there knocking on household doors. And in the first 3 years, through increasing energy efficient heating, insulation, draft proofing of doors and windows, all those kinds of things, hot water tank jackets, they got 34,000 tons of carbon done. They made some progress. It was successful. Kirklees Energy Services continued the work beyond the pilot with some municipal support and rebates. And then the national government in the UK in 2008, so they've had by this time 7 years experience under their belt, they had a UK warm zones program. And it was focused on decreasing fuel poverty. Now, fuel poverty isn't, just take a minute to talk about that, because fuel poverty is not something that's well understood as a term in probably Canada or the United States. It's starting to find its profile in Canada, but not much. In the UK, they consider any household that's spending 10% or more of its income on fuel to be fuel poor. So you can imagine there's a lot of seniors on fixed incomes, people who have low incomes, working poor and so on, that face this kind of problem. And as they say in the UK, that for every cent increase in the price of home heating fuel, 40,000 more households go into fuel poverty based on that definition.
I don't even think that it's a matter of just senior citizens. I think it's the general population. I mean, not everyone lives in a brand new house. And even for people that live in, whether it's a condominium complex or even an apartment building, some of these old brownstones even are not energy efficient. And I've traveled all over the United States. I've been to actually every state in the union except for Alaska and Hawaii. And from my travels, it's amazing just how many homes and businesses are not energy efficient. And you're talking about, and this is just in the United States, but you're talking about homes that maybe they're well kept, but as far as energy efficiency, now they've got a very long way to go. And I think primarily here in the United States is because of the fact that homeowners feel that the options are way out of their budget, number one. Number two, the technologies have been, for the most part, as far as homeowners are concerned, the education just isn't there. We need more education.
Well, this is what's so interesting about the approach that these folks took, right? Because they're integrating the whole piece. And so let me just tell you the next phase of this, because you just see how powerful this approach can be to getting at the kind of households you're talking about. I mean, we can talk about businesses later, but this one was focused on households, right? So given the fact that they had, you know, 7 years of experience, they were just really ready to take this up. So here you have a community-based organization with, you know, with some tested capacity now, able to coordinate a number of different resources and translate them, convert them into an integrated, simple, and very customer-oriented service to each household. What the local authorities did to bring money into play from, you know, and leverage the national dollars that the Warm Zone program had is that the municipal government put $14.1 million, I'm talking, you know, kind of equivalent Canadian U.S. dollars, and then the Scottish Power Utility put in $17 million, right? And they took that, and I'll tell you in a minute, but by the time you're finished, right, that money was leveraged 5-1. So you had, in 3 years, invested $157 million.
Wow.
And that was basically through just very modest but highly leveraged private and a bit of public support, primarily at the local and national level. So it was pretty interesting. So anyway, they, in now get this, in 3 years, there's 171,000 households. They knocked on every door and talked to people in the household. They carried out 74% energy audits in collaboration with the household, you know, within that three-year period. 30% in that 3 years had energy retrofits done, right? By the third year, right, they were reducing carbon at a rate of 55,000 tons a year.
Wow.
The households were saving $16 million. The local governments were happy because that released money to be spent on other things. They created 160 jobs. And 1,000 households exited fuel poverty, right? And they leveraged, for every public dollar they invested, they leveraged five times as much. And this isn't just for poor people, right? This was not just, you know, okay, we're going to do this for poor people because this program from the national level is just for poor people, and therefore you set up another organization just to deal with poor people. No, they already were able to integrate that into this combination of rebates. The credit unions were involved in lending. They had coordinated all of the vendors, ensured there was quality control, made sure that customer service was part of the tender to local suppliers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's amazing. That program, in their time, over a five-year period, they reduced on a prorated basis 80% of the carbon our national government through its program did in the same period at the local level, right? So that is absolutely amazing. And the difference is our government dropped it a year ago, and in Kirklees, they've expanded their reach to an area of 500,000, rebranded themselves to Yorkshire Energy Services, and they're still going and now actually moving into localized renewable installations, both solar and small-scale wind, and also working on alternative transportation in the region. So you can see this is very different, eh?
Mm.
It's very exciting, and what it tells us is that the challenges we face from an energy point of view are multi-level. There is no silver bullets, but if we ignore the kind of, if you will, community or sub-regional level, we're going to have real challenges, at least around the residential side, and that means less income for those households, more of it exiting the household and the community, and a whole lot more carbon being emitted and a failure to generate the jobs associated with local action on that particular energy front, which, of course, is just one of many.
Why do you think that the program that you just described has not been implemented on a broad scale in the United States?
Well, in the United States and Canada, well, I think it's partly ideological. I think that there's an overriding assumption that the market will take care of it. And in fact, that's, of course, patently wrong. Market is not taking care of it. And it's like many other energy problems, our fundamental belief systems can get in the way of real solutions. And I think that the private sector has a very important role to play. However, and what Kirkley's is illustrative of, it is the ability of Kirkley's energy services to integrate, qualify, and provide that core capacity to keep everything lined up with the public purpose, right? Which is to reduce energy use at the household level for a number of objectives. That is key, and that would not happen necessarily or probably rarely if it was just left to the normal kind of functioning of a private sector marketplace. So it's not either or. It's a question, how do we blend and create mechanisms for cooperation and collaboration and incentives that actually get the job done? And we need to expand that radically. And I think our own way we think about the world reduces our peripheral vision. And we need to see the landscape much differently than the simplistic kind of ideologically bound views that sometimes get in the way of good policy.
Well, I think that to a certain degree, when you take a look at things that not only affect our lives, whether it's from a personal or business perspective, the things that we've had to do as a society here in the States in order to get people to get moving, unfortunately, the government has had to step in and mandate certain make certain protocol, if you will. I'm trying to find an appropriate word here, but in order to get people to get moving, it has to be mandatory in order for it to happen. Case in point with the recycling of plastic water bottles. I mean, it was amazing just how much waste was produced, all because we couldn't simply take an empty container and recycle it. It had to be a mandatory 5-cent fee in order for people to do that. And there's still people that don't do it. They just, you know, toss it in the trash, which I find amazing, especially in this day and age where people understand what is at stake, but they still make that choice not to do it. Right. As a master composter, when I teach composting and recycling, it amazes me how many people just they don't feel like making the effort. And until it is mandated by the government, and I'm not a big fan of the government sticking its nose in my personal business, but unfortunately when it comes to something that has an impact not on just individuals but on society in general, unfortunately it seems as though that's something that needs to happen. Now, it's interesting when you take a look at China. China is very resourceful. They don't waste anything. And, in fact, I find it ironic that the things that we consider to be waste and trash, they buy, they refurbish it, recycle it, repurpose it, what have you, and then turn around and put it into a brand-new product and sell it back to us at a premium price. And
well, I think that's true. Yeah, in terms of recycling, I think being mandated and then certainly utilizing the waste stream. And but I think the key thing is that we often need combination of mandate, but also means by which people are, as you said earlier, educated and animated, but also, you know, there's some obvious benefit. I mean, in another one in the book that we deal with, Kristianstad in Sweden, which doesn't deal with energy-based conservation, it deals with the production of renewable energy. It's amazing what's happening there. I mean, you can imagine this, a district council, a municipality, there's 26 communities. The largest is 33,000. Smallest is 150, over 1,300 square kilometers. And they made a decision in 1999 that their major core priority was to become fossil fuel free. Well, it's a, and you know, by 2008, they were 50% of the way there. Think about that. And interestingly enough, going back to the waste stream, it's potato peelings. That's where the Absolute Vodka plant is, right? So all the agricultural processing waste, farm manure, and human waste are the basis for their biogas industry. And their biogas industry is generating enough electricity for 4,000 homes. And it's generating, at least 2 years ago now, around 4,000 or 5,000 liters of fuel that fuels their municipal fleet of transportation, and which is destined in another 6 years to be able to service 800 buses, as opposed to the 25 that was servicing 300 years ago. Where, but you know, here's an interesting thing again, right? Why is that working there? Well, obviously,
it's a collective political effort.
A political will, consciousness, and the municipality owns two key companies. One is a waste company, waste management company, and the other one is an electrical utility. And they have, with biofuels, biogas, and wind, now in a position where they are pretty much self-sufficient in electricity and a large part of their heating. And they also use district heating a lot for buildings, private and public. And they are probably within another, due to wind generation, within another 5 years, they're going to be in a position where they're exporting a considerable amount of electricity out of their region and be completely self-sufficient. So it's possible, but that is working because of consciousness, people being able to see the world differently. There are alternatives, but if you don't see the world differently, you're not going to mobilize the alternatives we already have at our disposal, because it does require a collaborative and cooperative effort between the public sector, the private sector, and civil society. And if we don't understand that, we're not gonna turn the corner. And in Kristianstad, it's just absolutely exciting to see what's possible. And this is really, I think, indicative of what's at the heart of this book. And we, you know, energy is just one of 13 chapters, but
yeah.
Is that we need to move from an imperative that's based on growth to an imperative that's based on resilience. And the two examples, just in terms of energy, are essentially indicators of the direction that the resilience imperative implies. More decentralized, you're democratizing and localizing ownership more. You're distributing and diversifying, you know, the energy sources in this case. And at the societal level, it's not like local energy solutions are the only level, but they are absolutely vital part of the solution. And we can see this, and that's where national governments can make a huge difference. I mean, in Germany and in Denmark, the progress they've made, which has been enabled by, you know, public policy, which has unleashed all kinds of activity at the household level, at the community level, in terms of people with land, farmers developing cooperatives for wind power. There's a lot of opportunities to change the ownership equation. It doesn't have to be just all big multinational centralized companies. We have an opportunity here as we move forward, you know, to have a more distributed and decentralized energy component to how we meet our needs for energy. And that's very exciting because that leaves us in an era where we're going to be confronted with real challenges. We already are, with the means by which we can be a bit more self-reliant closer to where we live. And that's really an important part of the resilience equation from our point of view.
Mr. Lewis, thank you so much. And we are out of time, but I would like to encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of your book, The Resilience Imperative, Cooperative Transitions to a Steady State Economy. And also visit his website, which is www.communityrenewal.ca. Mr. Lewis, thank you so much for coming on the show today. There's so many things that we do need to talk about, so I would like to have you come back at a future point so that we could talk about some of the other chapters in your book, which are equally as important.
Well, thanks so much, and I'm really encouraged to have this opportunity, and I really look forward to talking again. And people can pick the book up right off our site if they want, or and there's also, we're a nonprofit, so they can also donate there if you like. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.